Chapter 4. Jack Aubrey was not of a vindictive nature, and he had so nearly forgiven Stephen his good fortune by breakfast time that when the people of the hotel told him Dr. Maturin couldn't be roused, although a messenger had come to summon him to the Commander-in-Chief's meeting, he sprang to his feet and ran up the stairs to put him in mind of his duty. No answer to his knock or hail. "La! The poor gentleman is dead!" cried the chambermaid. "He has cut his throat like a number 17. I can't bear it. I shall run down all. Give me your pass-key first," said Jack. And walking through the door, he called out, "Rousen bit, out or down, show a leg there." And when this brought no response, he seized the sleeper and shook him hard. Stephen opened his red-rimmed eyes, struggled up through the fog of sleeping pills, and gave his friend a look of pure hatred. Jack had plucked him from a brilliantly vivid dream in which Mrs. Fielding felt a flame of equal warmth with his own. He took the wax balls from his ears and said, "What's a clock?" in a thick, stupid voice. "3:30 and a freezing, drizzly night," said Jack, drawing the curtain, throwing back the shutters and letting in a blaze of sun. "Come now, this'll never do." "What's your foot, sir?" asked Bondon in the doorway. He and Killick had arrived in the kitchen as the chambermaid came down with her tail of blood flowing under the door, just like number 17 all over again, and the poor gentleman's head almost off of his body, so desperate was the stroke, no doubt, and a mort of scrubbing to be done. "The doctor must be at the palace in 7 minutes, washed, shaved, and in his number one uniform," said Captain Aubrey. In an angry whine, Stephen said that his presence was not necessary, that the meeting such as it was would go along perfectly well without him, and that the note from the flagship should be construed not as an order, but as a mere invitation to be accepted or not, according to the... Jack walked out during these remarks, however, and as neither mercy nor reason was to be expected from Bondon or Killick, Dr. Maturin said no more until he was installed in a chair in the crowded council room very shortly before the arrival of the great man. His face was unusually pink from friction. His uniform and even his shoes were all they should be, and his wig was set rigidly square on his head. But his eyes were still bleary from want of sleep, and he gave his neighbour Graham little more than an animal grunt by way of good day. This didn't deter Graham for a moment. The words came fairly pouring from him as he hissed in Stephen's ear, "Do you know what they've done to me? They've ruined my dinner. I mustn't go on the returning dromedary on Thursday. No, sir, I must go aboard the Sylph today, at 12:30 precisely. Ruined, ruined. My dinner is quite ruined. And it's all the doing of that long-eared Luby Figgins. Poor cock! There he sits, the illiterate ill-deedy gout, next to the Admiral Secretary. Have you ever seen such a foul-fed face?" Stephen had seen fouler-fed faces by far, and quite often at that. In fact, although Mr. Pocock had an improbable amount of hair growing from his ears and nose, and although his cheeks were a dusty parched yellow, his looks compared rather well with Mr. Graham's. Though far from beautiful, Pocock's was a strong, mature, intelligent face, much more so than that of the Admiral's secretary, a surprisingly young man for such an important appointment. Not that Mr. Yarrow looked at all stupid, but he gave the impression of being anxious, inexperienced, and harassed. He was now clutching a great sheaf of papers and leaning towards Mr. Ray, listening to him with the utmost deference. The Commander-in-Chief, Sir Francis Ives, came in, and the meeting began. As Graham had predicted, a great many words were uttered and very little was said. But for some time Stephen looked attentively at Sir Francis. He was a small, compact admiral, rather elderly, but trim and unbowed in his splendid uniform, and he had an immense air of energy and natural authority. Although he belonged to a well-known naval family and had served with great distinction, he hadn't had a seagoing command for some years, and it was said that he intended to run the Mediterranean fleet with such effect that it would earn him a peerage at last. Both his brothers were lords, and no effort would be too great to overhaul them. He gazed round on the assembled officers and advisers with his odd hooded eyes as the talk went on, weighing them up but giving nothing away. A man thoroughly used to committees. Mr. Ray had the same ability to sit through long, meaningless speeches without apparent emotion. But his father-in-law, Rear Admiral Hart, an officer remarkable only for his wealth, his recently inherited wealth, and his lack of seamanship, had not. The Rear Admiral was glaring at Sir Hildebrand as the Governor went on and on, stating that although unauthorised persons might possibly have obtained information, none of the departments under his control could conceivably be held to blame. He had the utmost confidence in his officers, in his secretariat, and in all those concerned with the civil administration. Having contemplated Sir Francis long enough to see that his wall of reserve wasn't likely to give way, and that he would discuss serious matters only later in a smaller council, Stephen lost interest in the proceedings and sat there with his head bowed, at times allowing himself to doze, and at times sullenly eating pieces broken from the slice of toast that he darted into his pocket when Bondon wasn't looking. At intervals he heard gentlemen declare that the war should be prosecuted with the utmost vigour, and that no efforts should be spared, while others were of the opinion that there should be no relaxation of discipline, and that the heartiest goodwill and cooperation should prevail between the services. At one point he thought he heard the clever-looking soldier who fed Sir Hildebrand the figures and notes observe that he was opposed to tyranny and to the French domination of the world. But that might only have been a passing dream. In any event, neither he nor Graham was directly called upon to express an opinion. They both ignored all opportunities for intervention, and Graham, for one, spent his time being doggedly, ostentatiously silent. Stephen expected Ray, who had greeted him with a civil bow, to join him when the conference broke up and to enlarge upon the delicate affair he'd spoken of at their earlier meeting. I shall have to know much more of his mind and his discretion before I involve Laura Fielding, however, he reflected, for Laura had already put her head well into the noose, and although she would almost certainly be allowed to escape by turning King's evidence, a heavy official hand would cause her untold suffering. Furthermore, he preferred to carry out his mystification of the French agents without any interference. It was an infinitely delicate operation, and in his view it had to be performed by a single, well-practised hand. I shall not open myself today, he concluded. On the other hand, I shall be interested to hear what he has to say about Graham's André Le Sœur. In the event, he wasn't required to open himself, nor did he hear about Le Sœur, for Ray walked off deep in talk with the Admiral's secretary with no more than another bow and a significant look, as though to say, "You see how I'm taken up, my time is not my own." During these morning hours, Jack Aubrey was in the dockyard, conferring with the shipwrights far down in the bowels of his dear surprise. The shipwrights and those who controlled them were profoundly corrupt, but they did allow that there was a world of difference between government money and private money, and that a captain's personal outlay called for real value in return. Furthermore, they were capable of expert craftsmanship, and Jack was thoroughly satisfied with her fine new Dalmatian oak diagonal hanging knees and the stringers abaft the main chains where the frigate had been cruelly mauled. He also believed the shipwrights when they told him that, apart from Saints' Days, they had just over a full week's work to do. They were tolerably vague about the number of Saints' Days, however, And as Jack climbed the temporary ladders to the ravaged deck, brushing wood shavings off his coat and breeches, they sent for the calendar, telling off the holidays one after another, and disagreeing furiously about whether St. Anicito and St. Cucufat amounted to 12 hours or only an afternoon for carpenters as well as caulkers. Jack wrote it all down. He knew the Admiral of old. Sir Francis might not have been the first officer in the Navy to require his people to do everything at the double, but he was certainly one of the most forceful and persistent. He hated sloth on the quarterdeck as much as anywhere else. And when he called for a decision, a report, or a statement of a ship's condition, he liked to have it very briskly. Sometimes, of course, these brisk decisions, reports, or statements didn't wear quite so well as more deliberate, pondered versions. But, as he said, if you stand considering which leg to put into your breeches first, you're likely to lose your tide, and in the meanwhile your breech is bare. He maintained that speed was the essence of attack, and in his own actions this had certainly proved true. "Mr. Ward," said Jack to his clerk, who was waiting on the quarter-deck with the ship's open list under his arm, "be so good as to draw up a statement of conditions showing that Surprise should be ready for sea in 13 days, her guns in, her water completed, and her shrouds rattled down, and let me have it as soon as the muster's over." They walked over the brow to the black huts where the Surprises lived. Captain Aubrey was expected, and all his officers were present to receive him. Poor lost Thomas Pullings was also there, standing somewhat apart, so as not to appear to be encroaching upon the territory of William Mowat, his successor. 4 more commanders had been made in the Mediterranean fleet alone. They too had been turned loose upon the Maltese beach. And if any vacancy occurred, an improbable state of affairs, it was likely that one of them would be given it, all four having considerable interest. He now wore a plain round jacket rather than his gold-laced splendour, and an old, old sea-worn hat. But most of the other officers were also in working clothes, all indeed, except for Mr. Gill the master and Mr. Adams the purser, who both had assignations in Valletta, because as soon as the inspection was over, the whole ship's company was marching off to shoot for Mr. Pulling's prize, a weekly iced cake in the form of a target that was much valued by the men and that gave the commander a tenuous remaining connection with the ship. Marching off by boat, that is to say, for as nothing would induce them to keep in step or stand up straight, their officers were unwilling to parade them through streets filled with redcoats, and they were to be taken as far as possible by sea. They were now standing in free and easy attitudes, holding their muskets, more or less as they saw fit. And when, his formal tour being over, Jack said to Mowat, "Mr. Mowat, we'll muster by the open list, if you please." And Mowat said to the boatswain, "All hands to master." And the boatswain sprung his call, uttering the sequence of howls and short, sharp notes designed to bring people from the farthest depths of the orlop and forepeak. The seamen piled their weapons in heaps that would have made any soldier blush, and assembled in a straggling group on the bald, dusty stretch of ground that purported to be the larboard side of the quarterdeck. The clerk called their names, and one by one they crossed over just abaft an imaginary mainmast to the starboard, touching their foreheads to their captain as they did so and calling out, "Here, sir." They were a sadly diminished band. Although some, of course, were in hospital, naval prison or military guardhouse, many, far too many, had been drafted away. Yet for all that, Jack had fought with extraordinary fury for his older shipmates and his best seamen, sometimes going so far as substitution, misrepresentation, and downright falsehood when he was absolutely forced to give up a certain number. And now, as they crossed over, there was scarcely one he hadn't known for years. Some, indeed, had served in his very first command, the 14-gun brig Sophie. and among the rest there were hardly any boys, no landsmen, and no ordinary seamen. They were all able, and many of them might have been rated quartermaster in a flagship, at least as far as skill was concerned. They looked at him with mild affection as they went by, and he looked at them with profound disgust. Never, never had he seen such a squalid crew, crapulous, down-at-heel, frousty. Mowat and Rowan and the master's mates laboured heroically, keeping them busy through much of the day, but it would have been inhuman to deny them all liberty, and worse than inhuman, contrary to custom. And if this liberty were to go on much longer... Davis hadn't answered his name twice, repeated. "Has Davis run?" asked Jack eagerly. Davis was his old man of the sea, a dark, powerful, dangerous fellow who insisted upon volunteering or being transferred into any ship Captain Aubrey commanded, and nothing, nothing would induce him to desert. "I'm afraid not, sir," said Mowat. "He only took some Scotch soldiers' kilts away from them, and they've laid him up in their guard-room." Much the same kind of fate accounted for the temporary absence of three more surprises. Far graver was the real difference between this muster and the last, no less than 11 men having been taken to hospital. 4 with Malta fever, 4 with the great pox, 2 with limbs broken in drunken falls, and 1 pierced with a Maltese knife, while the 12th was in prison waiting trial for a rape. There were no desertions, however. Although several merchant vessels had been in and out, the surprises were mostly steady men-of-war's men, and they belonged to a happy ship. "Well, at least I have all the figures," said Jack, sighing and shaking his head. It was just as well that he'd got them then, for he'd scarcely finished his notes and uttered the wish that the frigate might have a chaplain, someone to reclaim them. The fear of hellfire might do better than the cat, anything to stop this wasting away, when a midshipman arrived at the double, requiring his presence aboard the commander-in-chief. Thanking heaven that he'd put on a good uniform for the muster, Jack said, "Captain Pullings, would you be so very kind as to take my place? I was just going to see our people at the hospital. Mr. Mowat, carry on. Bond and my gig. Youngster," to the flagship's midshipman, who had come across in a geyser, "come along with me. It'll save you fourpence." As the gig sped across the Grand Harbour, Jack said, "I thought the Admiral was ashore."
"So he is, sir," said the boy in his high, clear treble.
"But he said he'd be aboard long before I found you, and longer still before you put on your breeches." The gig's crew grinned, and Bawor uttered a strangled hoot. "But I didn't even go to the lady's house," the boy went on in perfect innocence, "because one of our bargemen said he'd seen you putting off at Nix Mangiare steps for the dockyard, and I found you first go." Going up the Caledonia's side, Jack noticed with satisfaction that the gathering of officers on the quarter-deck was far more impressive than was called for by the arrival of a mere post-captain. Clearly the Admiral had not yet returned. Indeed, the Caledonia's bell had time to be struck twice while Jack was talking to her commander, before the Admiral's barge was seen to shove off and come racing out, pulling double-banked as though for a wager. The whole quarter-deck stiffened, the boatswain's mates wetted their calls, the marines straightened their stocks, the side-boys put on their white gloves. The Admiral came aboard in style. Hats flew off, and marines presented arms with a ringing unanimous stamp and clash, while their officer's sword cut a gleaming curve in the sunlight and the boatswain's calls wailed over all. Sir Francis touched his own hat, glanced about the quarter-deck, caught sight of Jack's bright yellow hair, and called out, "Aubrey! Now that's what I call brisk. Good, very good. I hadn't looked for you this hour and more. Come along with me." He led the way to the great cabin, waved Jack to an elbow chair, settled behind a broad, paper-lined desk, and said, "First, I must tell you that Worcester is condemned. She should never have been attempted to be repaired. It's a damn job to firk money out of government. The new surveyors I've brought with me say that without she's completely rebuilt, she can never take her place in the line of battle, and she ain't worth it. We've already spent far, far too much on her. So, since we're in need of one, I've ordered her to be converted into a sheer hulk." Jack had been expecting this, and since he had the surprise for the present and the firmly promised Blackwater for the future, he wasn't much concerned, particularly as the Worcester was one of the few ships he'd known that he never could love or even esteem. He bowed, saying, "Yes, sir." The Admiral looked at him with approval and said, "How's surprise coming along?" "Pretty well, sir. I went over her this morning, and barring mishap, she should be ready for sea in 13 days. But, sir, unless I'm given a very large draft of men, I shall not have hands enough to work her. We've been bled white." "You have enough to work a moderate ship?" "Oh, yes, sir, enough to work and fight any sloop in the list." "Then I dare say most of them are seamen. I dare say you kept the hands that had served with you in other missions," said the Admiral, taking the list Jack brought from his pocket. "Yeah," he said, cocking it to the light and holding it at arm's length. "Scarcely a man that isn't rated able. Now that's just what I want." He searched among the folders on his desk, opened one, and said with his rare smile, "I believe I may be able to put you in the way of a plum. You deserve one after turning the French out of Margam." He looked through the papers for some minutes, while Jack gazed out of the stern windows at the vast sunlit Grand Harbour, with the Thunderer, 74, wearing red at the mizzen, gliding towards St. Elmo under topsails, before the west-northwest breeze, bearing Rear Admiral Hart away to the blockading squadron and its everlasting watch on the French fleet in Toulon. "Plum," he thought. "How I should love a plum. And there are precious few left in the Mediterranean. Can he be topping it the ironical comic?" "Yes," said the Admiral. "Turning the French out of Margot was a capital stroke. Now," taking a chart from the folder and speaking in quite another tone, in the rapid, urgent, emphatic way that came naturally to him when any naval undertaking was in hand, "bring your chair over here and look at this. Have you ever been in the Red Sea?"
"Only as far as Perim, sir."
"Well, now, here is the island of Mubara. Its ruler has some galleys and an armed brig or two. He's obnoxious to the Sublime Porte and to the East India Company, and it was thought he could be quietly deposed by a small force arriving unexpectedly, the company providing an 18-gun ship-rigged sloop, and the Turks a suitable body of troops and a spare ruler. The sloop's there, lying at Suez with a small crew of Lascars in conducting herself as a merchantman, and the Turks are ready with their soldiers. It was thought that Lord Lowestoft would go out, travelling overland with a party of seamen, and carry out the operation sometime next month. But Lowestoft's sick, and in any case a new situation's arisen. The French want a base for the frigates they have, and plan to have in the Indian Ocean. And although Mubara's rather far to the north, it's a great deal better than nothing. They offered the ruler, his name is Talal, and he's always been a friend of theirs, gunners and engineers to fortify his harbour, together with a present of gewgaws. But Talal wasn't interested in gewgaws. Hard cash was what he wanted, and a very great deal of it. Indeed, his demands have increased at every interview. I say his demands have increased at every interview."
"Pray, why is that, sir?"
"Because now there is a scheme for Muhammad Ali to conquer Arabia right down to the Persian Gulf, declare himself independent, and join with the French in bundling us out of India. And since Muhammad Ali has no navy in the Red Sea, Mubara has become very valuable indeed. All the more so as the French want it in order to keep a check on their ally. Furthermore, Talal has relations all along the coast. And the present has grown into a sum that is to bring them over to the French side too. Well now, they've come to an agreement at last. And Talal has sent one of his galleys down to Kassawa to take the Frenchmen aboard and to load the treasure. How much, I don't know. Some reports put it as high as 5,000 purses, some at only half as much. But they all agree it is the silver that Decon sent away from the Mauritius just before the island was taken, in a brig loaded to the gunwales. But you know all about that, of course. Of course he did. Apart from the last purely formal stages, when his admiral assumed command, Jack it was who had taken the Mauritius at the head of a small squadron. Yes, I said, I heard about that wretched brig. I even saw her hauled down to the north, but couldn't chase. I much regretted it. I dare say you did. Well, now, that was at the beginning of their Ramadan. When it's over, the galley will return. Do you wish to hear about their Ramadan, Aubrey? If you please, sir. It's a kind of Lent, but far more thorough paced. They are not allowed to eat or drink or have to do with women from sunrise to sunset, and it lasts from one new moon to the next. Some say travellers are excused, but these people, these Mubarayites, are uncommon pious. And they say that's all stuff. Everyone must fast or be damned. So, since no one can be expected to row a galley some hundreds of miles up the Red Sea, at this time of year the prevailing winds are all northerly and it's a matter of pulling all the way, galleys being so unweatherly, hundreds of miles, I say, without a drop of water under that infernal sun, nor yet a bite to eat, they mean to sit in Kassawa until Ramadan is over. Now, I don't like galleys. Frail, rickety affairs that can't stand a sea and too crank to bear much sail unless the wind is right aft. Dangerous, too, if two or three of them come up on you in a dead calm and hammer you for a while and then board you on both sides with several hundred men. Don't like galleys. But all officers with local knowledge and all our other informants agree that in those waters they're as regular as the post, pulling their 12 hours and then snugging down for the night. So, at least we know where to find them. The ship, cruising off the southern channel to Mubara, keeping well clear of these shoals and small islands here, you see, could hardly fail to intercept the galley with the treasure aboard on about the 15th day of the moon. She would then proceed to Mubara with the Turks for them to carry out the deposition, which is none of our business. That would call for rapid, well-coordinated movements, eh? Said Jack in reply to the Admiral's expectant pause. Speed is the essence of attack, said the Admiral. It also calls for a man who's not slack in stays and who's used to dealing with Turks and Albanians. Muhammad Ali is an Albanian, you know, and so are many of his soldiers and associates. That's why I thought of you. What do you say? I should be very happy to go, sir. And I'm much obliged to you for your good opinion. I thought you would be. And in any case, you're certainly the best man, being so well with the port. Your chelenk should give you far greater authority in those parts. You'll sail with all your people in the dromedary transport this evening, then, and you'll proceed to the eastern extremity of the Nile Delta, going ashore at a little out-of-the-way place called Tina on the Pelusian mouth, so as not to offend Egyptian sensibilities. They've never cordially liked us since that wretched business at Alexandria in the year 7. And travel overland to Suez with a Turkish escort. I wish I could send Mr. Pocock, my Oriental counsellor, with you, but I cannot. However, you will have a dragoman, a most exceptionally learned and able dragoman, an Armenian by the name of Harabedian. particularly recommended by Mr. Ray. And after dinner, Mr. Pocock will give you an outline of the political situation in those parts. I dare say you'd like Dr. Maturin to attend.
If you please, sir.
The Admiral looked at Jack for a moment and then said, "It was strongly urged that you should take another surgeon, that Maturin should be left here for consultation of one kind or another. But on mature consideration, I overruled that. In an enterprise of this kind, you want all the political intelligence you can get, and though no doubt Mr. Ray's high opinion of Harabedian is quite justified, it must not be forgotten that the poor fellow's only a foreigner after all. Now, I shall not load your mind with the details of the plan you're to carry out. You'll find them, together with a number of recommendations, in the orders that'll be writing while we have dinner. They would have been wrote before, but that we only had the news this morning. I wish it were dinner-time already. I had no breakfast. If it were not that guests are coming, I should have it put on the table this minute. But at least we could have something to drink. Pray touch the bell." The Admiral's rapid flow of words, his interlocking parentheses that didn't always come out, and his strong, emphatic way of speaking, left Jack Aubrey not indeed exhausted, but perhaps a little old, and certainly very willing to drink up a glass of Plymouth gin. As it went down, and as the Admiral was silently occupied with his own tankard of pale ale, Jack tried to dismiss his hurry of spirits, so as to look objectively at the scheme and at the plum it might contain. His excitement, his beating heart and his longing for it to succeed mustn't blind him to the fact that everything would depend on the wind. A few days of calm or of unfavourable breezes anywhere along the hundreds of miles up the Mediterranean or down the Red Sea would bring it all to nothing. And then there were Turks to deal with, as well as a completely unknown ship. The plan was somewhat visionary. It would call for consistent good luck in all its stages. Yet it was not an impossible stroke, by any means. One thing was certain, there wasn't a moment to be lost. "With your permission, sir," he said, putting down his glass, "I'll write a note to my first lieutenant, desiring him to have all hands ready to go aboard at a moment's notice. They're at small arms exercise behind Sliema at present."
"All of them?"
"Every man, Jack, sir, including the cook and my only two youngsters. I flatter myself our musketry's the finest on the station. We've shot against the 63rd without disgrace, and I believe we could take on any ship of the line. Every single man's there."
"Well, at least you'll not have to scour all the prisons and guardhouses and brothels and wine shops and low drinking booths in this goddamn town. Sodom and Gomorrah. Discipline goes by the board," said the Admiral. "But I wish you may not have turned them into a parcel of soldiers. If there's one thing I dislike more than another, it's a fellow dressed up like a ramrod in a red coat with powdered hair and pipe clay gaiters doing his exercise like a goddamn machine."
He was growing a little snappish from hunger. He looked at his watch and asked Jack to touch the bell again. But the Admiral fed was more amiable than the Admiral fasting. He had several other guests, a Monsignore, a travelling English peer, three soldiers, his secretary and three sailors, one of whom was the midshipman, or, to be more exact, the volunteer of the first class, who had come to fetch Jack and who turned out to be George Harvey, the Admiral's grand-nephew. Sir Francis was a good host. He gave his guests excellent food and a great deal of wine, and he never bored or puzzled the landsmen with the doings of ships either in peace or war. Indeed, the meal might almost not have been a naval dinner at all, but for its noble surroundings, the gentle rhythm of the living deck underfoot, the particular manner of drinking the king's health, and one small aspect of the proceedings. It was clear to Jack that the Admiral was very fond of his grand-nephew, and that he wished the boy to go the way he should, especially in the service line. This was very well, and Jack was entirely in favour of George's being guided in the right direction. He did a good deal of guiding youngsters himself when he had time. But he did feel that the Admiral, who had no children of his own, exaggerated a little. And it did make him uneasy to find that he was being held up as a model. He didn't mind the Admiral saying that nodding rather than bowing when taking wine with a man was a vile habit among the young people of today, and then shortly afterwards directing a meaning glance, a glance that would have pierced a 9-inch plank at the boy, who raised his glass, caught Jack's eye, and with a blush said, "The honour of a glass of wine with you, sir," bowing until his nose touched the tablecloth. But he didn't much care for being commended as an example of briskness. And he positively disliked it when Sir Francis observed that some officers had taken to putting RN on their visiting cards, a pert and flippant thing to do, meaning nothing, that Captain Aubrey, however, did not put RN on his card, and that when Captain Aubrey wrote a letter to a fellow officer, he didn't add a couple of foolish initials to the direction, but the words "of His Majesty's Navy." Captain Aubrey also wore his hat athwartships in the good old way, not fore and aft. These were only a few remarks in a general flood of conversation. The English traveller, who was very rich, and the prelate, who was very well with the King of the Two Sicilies, were not at all oppressed by a sense of rank. But they were enough to cause Jack's neighbours, post-captains of about his own seniority, a good deal of quiet pleasure. Captain Aubrey was, therefore, by no means sorry when dinner was over, and he was led to a small cabin where he found Mr. Pocock and Stephen already deep in the tortuous politics of the eastern end of the Mediterranean. They went through the main heads again for his benefit, and Mr. Pocock observed, "In the present delicate state of affairs, with Muhammad Ali doing all he can to win Osman Pasha's confidence, there'll be no difficulty about your journey overland. Indeed, the official at Tina has shown great goodwill in assembling a competent number of pack animals, such as camels and asses, and of course your Turkish decoration, your chelenk, will make you seem a person of real importance. A person of even greater importance, that is to say. Yet, even so, it would be as well to keep out of Ibrahim's way, a froward, turbulent fellow, impatient of control. And, of course, any encounter with the roving Bedouin is to be avoided. Not that they're likely to attack so large and well-armed a party as yours, for I presume your men will march with their weapons well in evidence." He then returned to the rise of Muhammad Ali and the fall of the Beys, unfortunately backed by the English government. But he'd scarcely slaughtered the last Mameluke before Sir Francis himself came in. "Here are your orders, Captain Aubrey," he said. "They're short and to the point. I hate verbiage. Now, I don't wish to hurry you away, but the last of the dromedary's remaining stores will be on the wharf in half an hour, far earlier than was expected. Your first lieutenant, what's his name?"
"Mowat, sir. William Mowat, a very capable active officer."
"Aye, Mowat. He set all Surprise's people on work, rigging an extra pair of sheets and clearing the forehold. So, if you choose to make any tender farewells on shore, now's the time."
"Thank you, sir," said Jack. "But I believe I shall leave my farewells for my return and pull across directly.
There's not a moment to lose."
"Quite right, Aubrey, quite right,"
said the Admiral. "And what's more, speed is the essence of attack. Goodbye to you, then. And I hope to see you again within a month or so, trailing clouds of glory, and perhaps something more substantial, too. Doctor, your humble servant."
Once more, the gig sped across the Grand Harbour, and as it sped, Stephen observed, "I had a very pleasant encounter this morning on leaving the palace. Do you remember Mr. Martin?
The Reverend Mr. Martin?"
"The one-eyed parson, that's to say the clergyman who preached so well on the subject of quails in Worcester, of course I do. A chaplain any first-rate would be proud of, and a great naturalist too, as I recall."
"Just so. He met me as I was turning into the Strada Reale and carried me to Rizzio's, where we had an excellent dinner, octopodes and squids in all their interesting variety. His ship has been among the Greek islands, and being particularly interested in cephalopods, he learned to dive with the sponge fishes of Lesina. But although he anointed his person with the best olive oil, and put oil-saturated wool in his ears, and held a large piece of sponge also soaked with oil in his mouth, and clung to a heavy stone to carry him down, and although there were cephalopods in plenty, he found he could not stay on the seabed for more than 43 seconds, which gave him pitifully little time to observe their ways or win their confidence. Even if he could have seen them clearly, which he could not by reason of the circumambulant water. And even then blood would gush from his ears, nose and mouth, while sometimes he would be hauled up insensible, so as to be obliged to be recovered with spirits of camphor. You may imagine then how interested he was when I told him about my bell. I am sure he was. I should like to see it again myself some day. So you shall. The bell is aboard the good dromedary once more, and Mr. Martin is there too, contemplating it. I'd taken him out to show him its finer points after dinner, and it was there that your message found me. What in God's name is that machine doing aboard the dromedary? Asked Jack. Sure, I couldn't burden Captain Dundas with it. And I wasn't going to leave my valuable bell among those thieves at the dockyard. The master of the dromedary was all complacence. He was used to the bell, he said, and it was welcome aboard. And I must confess that if we should have any leisure... Leisure? Cried Jack. If we're to be south of Ras Amina by the full of next moon or before, there'll be precious little leisure. Leisure, forsooth! Stretch out there, he called to the gig's crew. Pull hearty! The dromedary had warped across to the dockyard. She was tied up alongside the wharf. And there was no sign at all of leisure, upon her decks or between them. Sailors, carrying their bags, beds and hammocks, ran across the brows like ants, and vanished down the fore hatchway, while up the after hatchway ran others, those charged with cleaning out the holds, carrying huge bales of filth, bilge-soaked straw, light, bulky packing and broken sproggins, which they threw overboard together with improbable amounts of dust and spoilt flour. At the same time, water was coming aboard, and barrels of beef, pork and wine, and bags of biscuits and bales of slops, with Mr. Adams, his steward and Jack in the dust, the steward's assistant, skipping about them in a fine frenzy. While the crew of the transport, the dromedaries proper, were extraordinarily busy about their own affairs, and the whole forepart of the ship rang with the hammering of the carpenter and his crew. The diving bell stood like some archaic idol at the main hatch, but there was no Mr. Martin by it. Stephen walked right round the bell as well as he could for the hurrying crowd, and on his second circuit he came face to face with Edward Calamy, a young gentleman belonging to the Surprise. Mr. Calamy was technically a youngster, and, in fact, he'd only been at sea a matter of months, coming aboard the Worcester at Plymouth, a pale, nervous little boy. But no one would have thought so from his present hard-bitten, commanding demeanour and his profusion of nautical terms. For some time past he'd assumed a kindly, protective attitude towards Dr. Maturin, and now he called out, "There you are, sir. I was looking for you. I've nabbed you a little cabin on the larboard side of the cuddy. Come along out of the way. Watch your step on those Roman staves. Mr. Martin's down there. I took him, and so's all your dunnage." All Stephen's dunnage didn't amount to a great deal, his habits being of the simplest, but it did include a hortus siccus with specimens of the more remarkable Maltese plants, and the volume of the Philosophical Transactions in which Dr. Halley described his experiences at the bottom of the sea. Mr. Martin and he were deep in these, sheltered from the din, sheltered from the hurrying, urgent world, when the dromedary cast off her moorings, loosed her foretopsail, and moved out into the harbour, while Captain Pullings, standing desolate on the quay, waved goodbye to those few friends who were not too busy to notice him. Nor had they nearly exhausted the subject of sponges before the dromedary, now under all plain sail, rounded Point Ricasoli, and stood away east-southeast with a fine-to-gallant breeze. Still less that of corals. I have, of course, seen coral in the Indian Ocean and the great South Sea, vast quantities of it, said Stephen, but mine was only a most superficial view, limited in space and time, snatched away and hurried on I was, and often, often have I regretted my lost opportunities. For a contemplative mind, there can be few greater felicities than walking on a coral reef, with nondescript birds above, nondescript fishes below, and an unimaginable wealth of sea slugs, plumed worms, mollusks, cephalopods in the nearby depths. I'm sure there cannot be a much more blessed state this side of paradise, said Martin, clasping his hands. But you'll have plenty of coral again in the Red Sea, will you not? What makes you say that, my dear sir? Is not the Red Sea your destination? Do I mistake? Many people in Valletta spoke of a confidential expedition to those parts, and when the young gentleman brought me down here out of the press, he seemed to take it for granted that Captain Aubrey had been entrusted with the command, just as I took it for granted that you had brought your bell to dive upon the reefs at your leisure. But I beg your pardon if I've been indiscreet. Not at all, at all. To dive in the Red Sea would indeed be the rarest joy, above all at my leisure. But that, alas, is a word that offends the naval ear, and hardly ever, except when we were virtually cast down on Desolation Island, that blessed place, have I been allowed to do anything at my own pace, at my ease. There is a restless itch to be busy. A tedious, obsessive hurry. Waste not a minute, they cry, as though the only right employment for time were rushing forwards no matter where, so it be farther on. Very true. There's also a passionate and perhaps even a superstitious preoccupation with cleanliness. The very first thing I heard on setting foot aboard a man of war was the cry, "Sweepers!" And I suppose I must have heard it 20 times a day every day since then. Although with the perpetual swabbing and scrubbing, there's really nothing for a single broom to do, let alone a dozen. And now, sir, I fear I must take my leave. They say you're to sail by the evening, and already the light's growing dim. Perhaps we might take a turn on deck, said Stephen. There seems to be far less noise and hurry, and I'm sure Captain Aubrey would be happy to see you again. They made their way along the unfamiliar passages to the companionway. Yet even before they reached the deck, Stephen felt uneasy in his mind. The ship was leaning over more than she had a right to do, tied up against a quay. And the cry of "Cast loose your guns" didn't suit with any kind of preparation for sailing that he knew. But this uneasiness was nothing to the blank consternation that came over both of them when they slowly rose above the combings and found nothing but pure blue evening sea around them on every hand, the ship bowling along at 6.5 knots, and the sun preparing to set in glory right astern, while all along the deck on either side the seamen were wholly taken up with naval activities, as though the land no longer existed. Captain Aubrey had borrowed the dromedary's 6-pounders, and by way of recalling the surprises to some sense of decency, order and regularity, he was putting them through the great gun exercise, blazing away in dumb show at a furious rate. "How's your guns?" he said at last. "A very pitiful exhibition, Mr. Mowat. 2 minutes and 5 seconds with little 1,700-weight cannons, a very pitiful exhibition." He turned, and his grim expression instantly lightened as he caught sight of Stephen and Martin. They were still both standing transfixed on the penultimate step of the ladder which cut them off at the knee, and they were both staring away to leeward with their mouths open, looking like a pair of moonstruck landsmen.
"And, poor fellows, I'm afraid they're a little better," he thought.
"Mr. Martin, sir," he said, stepping towards them. "How happy I am to see you again. How'd you do?"
"Heavens, sir," said Martin, weakly shaking his hand, and still gazing about the horizon as though land or a miracle might appear. "It seems as though I've been carried away. As though I didn't leave the ship in time.
No great harm. I dare say we shall see of a letter fishing boat that'll carry you back, unless you choose to bear us company for a while. We're bound for the Pelusian mouth of the Nile."
A very shocking battle between the dromedary's carpenter and Hollard, boatswain of the Surprise, both irascible men, broke out at this moment, and Captain Aubrey was obliged to break off. But he invited the chaplain to supper, and at this meal Martin said, "Sir, perhaps you weren't speaking seriously when you suggested that I should accompany you, but if you were, allow me to say that I should be very happy to do so. I have a month's leave from my ship, and Captain Bennett was good enough to say that he would have no objection whatsoever were I to prolong it by another month, or two, or even more." Jack knew that Bennett had accepted a parson only under pressure from the former commander-in-chief. It was not that Harry Bennett had anti-clerical notions, but he dearly loved female company, and as his ship was often on detached service, he often indulged in it. Yet his respect for the cloth was such that he felt he couldn't ship a miss and a parson at the same time, and this he found a very grievous restraint. "I should, of course, pay my battles, and I could perhaps help Dr. Maturin, since he has no assistant at the moment. I'm not unacquainted with anatomy."
"With all my heart," said Jack, "but I must warn you that we don't mean to linger at Tina. We're to march across a desert filled with serpents of various malignities, as the doctor puts it."
"I was only quoting Goldsmith,"
said Stephen sleepily. The emotions of yesterday and his short night were overpowering him now, and he murmured,
"Sopor, coma, lethargy, Karas.
As far as the Red Sea, where we must carry out a mission that's sure to be strenuous and very hot and uncomfortable, and that may well be dangerous, too." As he spoke, he saw a glow of delight spread over Martin's face. In spite of obvious efforts to maintain a grave and serious countenance. "Furthermore," said Jack, "I must tell you that the service isn't designed for those that wish to gather beetles and henbane on some far coral strand, and that grow snappish and petulant when desired to mind their duty. That murmur and look dogged," he said a little louder. But seeing that Stephen wouldn't respond, he ended, "Apart from that, I should be very happy to have your company. And so, I'm sure, with all your shipmates in the Worcester. We've not forgotten how you laboured in preparing the oratorio. Perhaps some evening we may have a chorus or two. There are several of your old pupils aboard." Mr. Martin said that the serpents, the exertion, heat, discomfort and danger were a small price to pay for beholding a coral reef, even though it mightn't be lingered on, that he should certainly do his duty without murmuring, and that he was very happy to be among his old shipmates again. "Now that I come to think of it," said Jack, "I was regretting the absence of a chaplain only this morning. The people have grown horribly dissipated, and it occurred to me that..." He'd been about to say that a thundering hellfire sermon might terrify them into good behaviour, but on recollection it didn't seem to him quite the thing to dictate his course to a parson, and he went on, "that it would be as well to rig church, so that they might hear some suitable words against vice and dissipation, I mean." "What now, Killick?" "Which Mr. Mowat asks may disturb you, sir," said Killick.
And since he'd like to be the first with any news going on, he added, "Don't know where to stow the foreign gent. Beg him to come in. Place a chair and fetch another glass." The foreign gent was the dragoman, and Mowat, sitting down and drinking a glass of port, asked whether he was to sling his hammock before the mast or aft, and where was he to mess. "Where dragomans, or dragomen, mess in general, I don't know," said Jack. "But the commander-in-chief spoke of this one as uncommon clever, particularly recommended by Mr. Secretary Ray. So I think he must eat in the gun-room. I saw him for a moment when he came aboard, and although he's said to be so learned, he looked a reasonably cheerful soul. I don't think he'll regret it, and in any case I hope, I very much hope, it'll not be for much longer than a week. And it will not be, if only this blessed wind holds. Nelson's wind. Lord, I remember when we were after the French fleet in 98, and how we ran from the Straits of Messina to Alexandria in 7 days. Those long, urgent summer days shone clear in his mind. The blue, white-flecked sea and 15 men-o'-war racing eastwards on that blessed wind, stunsails aloft and alow on either side, royals and skysails, and Rear Admiral Nelson pacing the vanguard's deck from before sunrise until after sunset. All that, then the fury of the battle by night with the darkness perpetually torn and lit by gunfire, and in the midst of it all, the unbelievably vast explosion as Lorient blew up, leaving nothing but silence and blackness for several minutes after. He described the search for the French, and had carried the fleet from Alexandria back to Sicily and from Syracuse to Alexandria again. And there we found them at last, moored in Aboukir Bay, when the dromedary gave a modest heave and pitched Stephen fast asleep from his chair. Jack made a nimble spring, creditable in a man of his weight, but not quite nimble enough to prevent Stephen from striking his forehead on the edge of the table and splitting the skin a hand's breadth across, a reasonably close imitation of Nelson's wound at the Nile and almost as bloody. "All this confusion and calling out!" said Stephen angrily. "One would think you'd never seen blood before, which is absurd in a band of hired assassins. Mom, capon, malthorse, lobcock!" This to Killick. "Hold the basin straight. Mr. Mowat, in the top left-hand drawer of my medicine chest you will find some curved needles with gut already to them. Pray be so good as to bring me a pair together with a phial of styptic in the midmost rack and a handful of lint. My neckcloth will serve for a bandage. It's already in need of washing." "Should you not lie down?" said Jack. "The loss of blood..." "Nonsense! It's merely superficial, I tell you. Mere hide, no more. Now, Mr. Martin, I'll thank you to apply the styptic and to place 12 neat sutures while I hold the lips of the wound." "I don't know how you can bear to do it," said Jack, looking away as the needle went deliberately in and through. "I'm accustomed to stuffing birds," said Martin, working steadily on, "and to sewing them up. Much more delicate skin than this very often, except in the case of old male swans. There, I flatter myself that is a tolerably fine seam." "The chaplain says you're all right now, sir," said Killick in a loud, officious voice close to Stephen's ear. "Sir, I'm obliged to you," said Stephen to Martin, "and now I believe I shall retire. I had but a short night of it, gentlemen, your servant. Mr. Mowat, I beg you will leave my arm alone. I am neither drunk nor decrepit." He had but a short night of it again, since just before dawn an unknown, very passionate voice, not 6 inches from the cuddy scuttle, cried, "Don't you know how to seize a cuckold's neck, you goddamned lubber? Where's the bleeding seizing?" with such force as to banish sleep. His forehead hurt, but not very much.
and he lay there swinging with the long motion of the ship, watching the grey light grow, and musing upon cuckoldry, cuckoldom, and the almost universal mirth excited by that state. When he was in Malta, one of the few letters he received from England, the Mediterranean fleet had been extraordinarily unlucky in the matter of post these last 2 months, had told him that he was a cuckold, that his wife was deceiving him with a gentleman attached to the Swedish embassy. He didn't believe it. The same bag had brought him a hurried, blotted, but most affectionate scrawl from Diana, and although he didn't suppose that any ordinarily moral considerations would stop her from doing whatever she had a mind to do, he did know that she was a gentlemanly being, and that a highly personal aesthetic sense would prevent her writing him such a note at a time when she was adorning his forehead with horns. He was persuaded that she would not disgrace him unprovoked. On the other hand, she lived an active social life in London. She had many rich and fashionable friends. And since she'd never given a damn for public opinion, he had no doubt that she laid herself open to unkind or envious tattle. Her cousin Sophie, Jack Aubrey's wife, was completely different. She was not a prude, and she cared no more for Mrs. Grundy than Diana. And yet no one but a maniac would ever write to tell Jack that he was a cuckold, although on a basis of reciprocity he deserved a whole hall full of antlers. He pondered upon this. Was it a question of sexual appetite, or rather of potentiality dimly yet accurately perceived by others? He pondered upon sexual appetite in elegant females as opposed to the freer products of nature. And he was pondering still when the cabin door quietly opened and Jack looked in. "God and Mary be with you, Jack," he said. "I was just thinking about you. Pray, what is a cuckold's neck by sea?" "Why, if you wish to make a rope fast to a spar, you cross its two parts the one over t'other, and clap a seizing on them, and that's your cuckold's neck. But tell me, how do you do?" "Very well, I thank you. Perhaps you'll take a little weak tea and a lightly boiled egg?"
"I will not," said Stephen in a strong, determined voice. "I will take a large pot of strong coffee like a Christian and some kippered herrings."
Jack considered for a moment, and then said with a stern look, "What the devil did you mean by saying I was thinking about you? What is a cuckold's neck?"
"Someone hallooed the words outside my window. I wanted to know what they meant, so I asked you as a nautical authority. I desire you will not top it the Othello, brother, for shame suff on you. If any man so far forgot himself as to make a licentious suggestion to Sophie, she wouldn't understand him for a week. And then she'd instantly lay him dead with your double-barrelled fowling piece.
It's kind to call me a nautical authority," said Jack, smiling at the idea of Sophie slowly coming to understand the hypothetical rake, and her polite attention changing to icy rage. "And you may call me a nautical diplomat, too, if you choose. I had a most satisfactory interview with the master of the dromedary last night. It's a very, very delicate matter, telling a man how to conduct his ship or suggesting improvements, you know. And Mr. Allen is in no way my subordinate. Besides, the masters of merchant ships often have a grudge against the Navy for pressing their men, and they resent the airs some officers give themselves. If I'd offended him, he might, out of mere contrariness, have reduced sail to courses alone. But, you see, he came below to ask what was afoot just after you'd turned in. He'd been told that you had attacked us in a drunken frenzy, and that we'd beaten you almost to death. And he stayed to drink a glass while I finished telling Mowat and the parson how the squadron cracked on like smoke and oakum, sailing over this very same tract of water before the Battle of the Nile." "I believe I remember your mentioning the Nile," said Stephen.
"'I'm sure you do,' said Jack kindly. "'Well, now, he proved a most capital fellow. "'Once it appeared that we didn't mean to take him up short "'or snub him aboard his own ship. "'And when Mowat and the parson were gone, "'I put it to him frankly. "'Brought it out without any guile or premeditation. "'I didn't criticise his handling of the dromedary in any way, "'he was to understand. "'He knew her humours and her possibilities better than any man.' But I should be happy to offer him a couple of score of hands, and if, with a much stronger crew, he saw fit to spread more canvas, and if in consequence anything should carry away, why then I should be perfectly happy to indemnify his owner straight away and out of hand. He said he asked nothing better, had seen me fretting, but couldn't put himself forward for fear of being brought up with a round turn. Yet I mustn't expect too much of the old hooker, even if she was manned like Jacob's ladder or the Tower of Babel, because not only was her bottom foul, but she hadn't a mast, no, nor a yard that was not more woolding in fishes than wood, and all her rigging was twice-laid stuff, though indeed she had the lines of a swan, the sweetest lines he'd ever seen, and with a proper crew she could show a fine turn of speed with the wind before the beam. So we shook hands on it, and when you go on deck you'll see a very different state of affairs. To a seaman's eye it was, no doubt, a very different state of affairs. The dromedary having set her weather stunsails, her spritsail and her spritsail topsail. But Stephen was more immediately struck by a row of scarlet patches on the deck. The dromedary had not yet rigged any awnings, and the brilliant sunlight gave the red an extraordinarily vivid life. A pleasure to behold. He contemplated the scene, slowly adjusting his nightcap so that it shouldn't press on his stitches, and presently he understood what was happening. The crew of the Surprise were being mustered with arms and bags. The order, "On end clothes," had been given, and each man's possessions were now in a heap in front of him, a meagre heap, but in almost every case one topped by a beautifully laundered, pressed and folded pair of white duck trousers, a watchet blue jacket with brass buttons, and an embroidered waistcoat, usually scarlet, for the frigate had recently touched at Santa Maura, famous for cloth of that colour. These garments, the hand shore-going rig, were carefully spread abroad, in an attempt at concealing the absence of a proper supply of everyday clothes beneath. A perfectly hopeless attempt, even with a newly joined youngster, let alone a post-captain who'd spent most of his life at sea, but one that a sort of imbecile cunning had suggested to almost every man on deck. Jack angrily poked about among the unsaleable rags concealed beneath the finery, and dictated the list of clothes required to the officer of the division. It was worse than he'd expected. The arms were in excellent order, for in the hope of deprecating wrath, the men had furbished their muskets, bayonets, pouches, pistols, cutlasses, to a state of more than military brilliance. But the clothes were in a very shocking state. "Come, place," he said to an elderly forecastleman. "Surely you must have something in the way of a spare shirt. You had several embroidered down the front when last we mustered bags. What's happened to them?" Place hung his grizzled head and said he couldn't tell, he was sure. "Perhaps it was them rats," he suggested without much conviction. "Two shirts and two duck frocks for Place, as well as the stockings and petticoat trousers," said Jack to Rowan, who wrote it down. And they passed on to the next shiftless soul, who in a drunken frolic had contrived to leave himself with only one shoe as his whole sea-stock. "Mr. Calamy," said Captain Aubrey to the young gentleman attached to this division, "tell me what constitutes a well-regulated seaman's kit in high latitudes. A sober, responsible seaman in a king's ship, I mean. Not a fly-by-night piss-in-the-corner privateersman that cannot hold his liquor. 2 blue jackets, sir, 1 pea jacket, 2 pair of blue trousers, 6 shirts, 4 pairs of stockings, 2 Guernsey frocks, 2 hats, 2 black Barcelona handkerchiefs, a comforter, several pair of flannel..." He blushed.
Jan in a low voice said, drawers.
And two waistcoats, as well as one bed, one pillow, two blankets and two hammocks, sir, if you please.
And in warm climates?
Four duck frocks, sir, four pair of duck trousers, a straw hat and a canvas one for squalls.
And any man that falls short of this by his own vicious waste and negligence or vile debauchery deserves to be on the defaulters list. Deserves to be brought to the gangway, seized up to a grating, and given a round dozen for every item he doesn't possess. Is that not so?
Yes, sir.
Very faintly.
This man is in your division. He's one of your boat's crew. Yet knowing all this, you've seen him bring himself down to one solitary shoe. Haven't you no sense of responsibility for your men, Mr. Calamy? You're a disgrace to the service. Your grog is stopped until further notice. This is very bad.
It was indeed even worse than Jack had expected. Acquainted though he was with squalor, naval squalor, but he and Mr. Adams had provided for something near total destitution. And all that morning the purser's steward served out slops, while all that afternoon those surprises who made no part of the dromedary's watch on duty sat in little groups on deck, unpicking the Navy Board's contractor's slops, carefully refitting, recutting and re-sewing them again, to avoid the intolerable reproach of looking like a pusser shirt on a handspike.
Jack, rambling about the upper rigging with Mr. Allen and discussing various ways of increasing the ship's pace when the breeze should haul forward, looked down on a deck that resembled a tailor's sweatshop, with shreds of cloth everywhere and ends of thread and earnest forms sitting cross-legged, bowed over their work, right arm rising, needle flashing rhythmically. He looked down with guarded satisfaction, for not only were the hands recovering from their debauchery, but even with the wind right aft, by no means the dromedary's or any other square-rigged vessel's favourite point, she was throwing a modest bow wave and running at 5 knots 4 fathoms, enough to accomplish the voyage in a week with an unchanging breeze. The wind was in the same quarter the next day and the morning after that, and most of the surprises were still busy with needle and thread. Their working clothes were now in order, and they were moving on to the fine work. It was known the church was to be rigged on Sunday. Mr. Martin was already leading some of the better voices through the old hundredth in the empty forehold, and the deck vibrated like the soundbox of some vast instrument, and it was thought that the dromedaries would attend dressed fancy. The surprises had no intention of having their eyes wiped by a parcel of merchantmen, and since, on the one hand, shore-going rig would be ostentatious and inappropriate, while on the other there was no time for really delicate embroidery, they were putting ribbon in their seams. Yet some had taken time off to polish the doctor's bell, and now the massive plates of lead that covered its lower sides gleamed as brightly as sand and brick dust could ever induce lead to gleam, while the brass top, of course, outfaced the sun. This they'd done by way of expressing their sympathy, for Stephen, walking about with a bloody nightcap, was a pitiful sight. And as they were all perfectly convinced that he'd been dead drunk when he received his wound, they'd even more than their usual kindness for him. But today no nightcap was to be seen. It had been represented to Dr. Maturin on all sides that since the surprises captain and officers had invited the master of the dromedary and his first mate to dinner, a wig must be worn, however great the agony. It might be pushed back after the cloth was drawn, they said, and it might even be taken off altogether if they should chance to sing towards the end of the meal. But in the early stages it was as necessary as a pair of breeches. In a wig, therefore, Stephen walked forward to his temporary sick bay, examined and confirmed 2 new cases of syphilis, abused them for presenting far too late as usual, would lose their teeth and noses and even lives if they didn't follow his instructions to the letter, their wits they'd lost already, stopped their grog,
put them on number two low diet, started them on a course of salivation, and told them that the cost of their physic should be stopped out of their pay. He then looked at a dromedary distracted with toothache, decided that the tooth must come out, and sent for the drummer and two of the man's messmates to hold his head.
"Which we ain't got no drummer, sir," said his loblolly boy. "All the jollies was left at Malta."
"Very true," said Stephen, "but a drum I must have." He wasn't very good at drawing teeth, and he liked his patient to be deafened, amazed, stupefied by a thundering in his ears.
"Has the ship never a drum for a fog?"
"No, sir," said the dromedary's messmates.
"We uses conches and a musket."
"Well," said Stephen, "that might answer too. Let it be so. My compliments to the gentleman in charge of the watch, and may I have conches and a musket." "No, stay. The galley must surely have cauldrons and kettles that could be beat." But few messages are ever perfectly understood, few are delivered unimproved upon, and the tooth came out. Came out at bloody last, piece by piece, to the howling of conches, the fire of two muskets, and the metallic thunder of several copper pots. "I beg pardon for being late," said Stephen as he slipped into his seat, for Jack and his officers and their guests were already at table. "I was delayed in the sick bay."
"It sounded as though you were having a battle there,"
said Jack.
"No, it was only a tooth, a troublesome tooth. Should have delivered many a child with less pains to all concerned."
The remark was generally considered to be in very poor taste, and indeed Stephen would never have made it had he not been so hurried. At ordinary times he perfectly recollected the odd delicacy of sailors where gynaecological matters were concerned. Now he relapsed into silence, and having eaten enough soup to take off the keen edge of his appetite, he looked about the table. Jack sat at its head with the captain of the dromedary on his right, and Mr. Smith, her first mate, on his left. Then next to Mr. Allen came Mowat with Rowan opposite him, while Stephen, Mowat's neighbour, faced Martin. Mr. Gill, the master of the surprise, sat to the right of Stephen, with Harabedian the dragoman over against him, while the two master's mates, Honey and Maitland, were on either side of Mr. Adams, who, as vice-president of the mess, sat at the foot of the table. In the presence of their captain, these two young men were dead weights at the present utterly sober stage of the meal, and the melancholy Gill would be perfectly mute at all stages, having no conversation whatsoever. Martin and Herabedian, unburdened by the weight of naval convention, were already talking away in the middle of the table, but at the head Jack would have had to go through the usual hard labour of flogging things along until the dinner got under way, if it hadn't been for the fact that just before his arrival his two lieutenants had very nearly come to blows over the meaning of the word dromedary. They were both good seamen and amiable companions, but they were both given to writing verse, Mowat being devoted to the heroic couplet, while Rowan preferred a Pindaric freedom, and each thought the others not only incorrect, but devoid of grammar, sense, meaning, and poetic inspiration. At two bells in the afternoon watch, this rivalry had spilled over onto the name of the transport. Why, it was difficult to make out, since dromedary couldn't conceivably be made to rhyme with anything. And both were still so heated that although Captain Aubrey was at this time quietly engaged with his Valletta mutton, Rowan called across the table,
"Come, Doctor, as a natural philosopher, you'll certainly confirm that the dromedary is the hairy animal with two bunches that moves slow?"
"Nonsense," said Mowat. "The Doctor knows perfectly well that the dromedary has one bunch and moves quick. Why else will it be called the ship of the desert?" Stephen darted a look at Martin, whose face was studiously blank, and replied,
I shouldn't like to commit myself, but I believe the word is used somewhat loosely according to the taste and fancy of the speaker. Much as sailors say sloop for a vessel with one mast or two or even three. And you are to consider that as there are swift-sailing sloops and slow, so there may be brisk and sluggish dromedaries. Yet I am inclined to suppose, if only from the example of this excellent ship of Captain Allen's, that the ideal dromedary is a creature that moves fast, giving one a smooth and agreeable ride, however many bunches it may have. Some say dromedary, observed the purser, and there Jack cut the topic short as being perhaps distasteful to their guests. But the word had sunk into Mr. Allen's mind. And after a while, peering round Mowat, he said to Stephen, "Sir, I thank you kindly for your attention to poor Poll Wheel's tooth, but pray why did you need a drum to draw it?" "Oh," said Stephen, smiling, "it's an old mountebank's trick, to be sure, but it has a real value. The tooth-drawer's man is Jack Pudding, or Merry Andrew, beats the drum at the fair, not only to drown the sufferer's screams, which might deter other customers, but also to induce a partial temporary insensibility, which gives his master time to work. It's empirical, but it's sound practice. Again and again I've noticed that when the ship is in action and men are brought below, they are often scarcely aware of their wounds. Indeed, I have taken off mangled limbs, hearing scarcely a groan, and many a sad gash have I probed with the patient talking in a normal voice. This I attribute to the din of battle, the excitement, and the extreme activity." "I'm sure you're in the right of it, Doctor," cried Mr. Allen. "Only last year we had a set-to with a privateer in the chops of the Channel, a Sam Marlowe lugger that brought up the breeze, sailing 3 miles to our two. She gave us a couple of broadsides and boarded us in the smoke. And not to spin a long yarn of it, we persuaded them to go back into their boat, the Victor of Sam Marlowe she was, as quick as ever they come out of her, and she sheered off. But what I mean is, when it was all over and I was sitting down to a cup of tea with Mr. Smith here, nodding at his mate, who nodded solemnly back as though on oath, I felt something queer in my shoulder, and taking off my coat, there was a hole in the cloth and a hole in me too, and a pistol ball lodged so deep it had almost gone through. I'd felt the blow, mark you, but thought it was only a falling block and paid no attention." "Yes," cried others, and much the same had happened to them or to their friends. And after a decent pause, in which Captain Aubrey gave an account of a ball that had entered his side when he was a master's mate, that had been indistinguishable from a pike thrust received at almost the same moment, and that had wandered about his person until he was a commander when the doctor extracted it from high up between his shoulders, several more anecdotes came out at once, giving the dinner a pleasant, convivial, if somewhat ogreish, sound. From then on, talk and laughter didn't cease, and Stephen, who'd lately been at some pains to play a social part, sank back into his more usual silence, musing on Mrs. Fielding until the cloth was drawn. Then, while they were eating figs and green almonds, he saw Rowan lean forward and call down the table to the dragoman. "Did I hear you say you'd met Lord Byron?" "Yes," said Mr. Herabedian. He'd had the honour of dining in his company twice, together with several of the Armenian merchants of Constantinople, and once he'd passed a towel as his lordship emerged, shivering and somewhat blue, gentlemen, from the Hellespont. Stephen looked curiously at his little round, merry face to see whether the words were true. Many, many people had he met in Valletta who had known Byron, the women repelling his advances and the men taking him down a peg or two. Herabedian was probably telling the truth, he decided. He hadn't had much contact with him, but the interpreter was clearly an intelligent man,
He'd told Martin a good deal about the Monophysite Armenian and Coptic churches, showing a nice appreciation of the difference between Homoousian and Homoousian, and he had gained the good opinion of the gunroom, not indeed by talking much, although his English was nearly perfect, but rather by reason of his jolly, twinkling eye, his most infectious high-pitched laugh, his habit of listening attentively, and his admiration for the Royal Navy. At this point, Mowat was called away, much against his will, and while Rowan and Martin and even the purser and master's mates eagerly questioned Harabedian, Mr. Allen leant over towards Stephen and said, "Who is this Byron they're always talking about?" "He's a poet, sir," said Stephen. "One that writes excellent doggerel with flashes of brilliant poetry in it. But whether the poetry would flash quite so bright were it not for the contrast, I cannot tell. I've not read much of him."
"I like a good poem," said Mr. Allen. Jack coughed. The talk died away. And filling his glass from one of the fresh decanters, he said, "Mr. Vice, the King." "Gentlemen," said Mr. Adams, "the King." After this, they drank to the dromedary, to the surprise, and to wives and sweethearts. And Jack said to Mr. Allen, "If you like a poem, sir, you've come to the right shop. Both my lieutenants are capital poets. Rowan, tip the captain your piece about Sir Michael Seymour's action, the first one. Start in the middle, so as not to be too long." "Well, sir," said Rowan, beaming upon Mr. Allen, "it was the one with the thetis, you know." And without the least change in his conversational tone, he went on, "I do declare such a hard engagement has not been known for many a year. At 7 in the evening the battle it begun, and lasted many hours before it was done. Great numbers there was wounded, and many too was slain, while the blood from off the decks did change the watery main. 3 hours and 20 minutes we held this dreadful fray. We lashed her fast unto us, she could not get away. Many times they tried to board us, but we drove them back so fast, although they were so numerous, we made them yield at last. Then down she hauled her colours, no longer could she fight. Our British tars, they gave 3 cheers all at this noble sight. We took possession of her without any more delay, and sent her into Plymouth Sound then, my boys, straight away. Great store of artillery ammunition too, likewise. 1,000 barrels of flour to our tars become a prize. She was bound out to Martinico, the truth I do declare, but in the night we met her and stopped her career." Mowat came back during the last lines, and seeing his look of fairly well-disguised disappointment, Jack said to Mr. Allen, "My first lieutenant's poems are equally appreciated, sir, but they're in the modern taste, which perhaps you may dislike." "No, sir, not at all," said Allen, now strikingly red in the face and very apt to laugh. "I like it of all things." "Then perhaps you'd give us the piece about the dying dolphin, Mr. Mowat," said Jack. "Well, sir, if you insist," said Mowat eagerly. And having explained that this was part of a poem about people sailing in the archipelago, he began in a hollow boom, "The sailors now, to give the ship relief, reduce the topsails by a single reef. Each lofty yard with slackened cordage reels, rattle the creaking blocks and ringing wheels. Down the tall masts the topsails sink amain, and soon reduced assume their post again. And now, approaching near the lofty stern, a shoal of sportive dolphins they discern. From burnished scales they beamed refulgent rays, till all the glowing ocean seemed to blaze. Soon, to the sport of death, the crew repair, dart the long lights, or spread the baited snare. One in redoubling mazes wheels along, and glides unhappy near the triple prong." Stephen's mind wandered back to Laura Fielding, and his perhaps untimely, unnecessary, foolish, unprofitable, sanctimonious chastity. and he was brought back to the present only by the applause that greeted the end of Mowat's recitation. Above the general noise rose Mr. Allen's strong, sea-going voice, now free from the genteel restraint of some decanter's back. He said that, although the dromedary couldn't return the compliment in kind, having no gentleman of equal talent aboard, she could at least reply with a song, goodwill supplying what it might lack in harmony. "Ladies of Spain, will you," he said to his mate, "beat three times on the table," and together they sang, "Farewell and adieu to you fine Spanish ladies, farewell and adieu all you ladies of Spain, for we've received orders to sail for old England, and perhaps we shall never more see you again." Almost all the hands knew the song well, and they joined in the chorus with splendid conviction. "We'll rant and we'll roar like true British sailors, we'll range and we'll roam over all the salt seas, until we strike soundings in the channel of old England, from Ushant to Scilly 'tis 35 leagues. Then the captain and his mate again. "We hove our ship to when the wind was sou'west, boys, we hove our ship to for to strike soundings clear. Then we filled our main topsail and bore right away, boys, and right up the channel our course we did steer." Far below, in the midshipman's berth, the excluded youngsters began the next verse before the gunroom, and their pure voices sang, "The first land we made is known as the Dodman. Next, Ramehead near Plymouth, Start, Portland, and White." But Stephen's most valuable recollection of the dinner was Herr Obedien's delighted face, his twinkling eyes, and his countertenor soaring above the thunder, declaring that he too, like a true British sailor, should roam over all the salt seas.